It's showtime.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
You know, the right to bear arms is because that's the last form of defense against tyranny.
Washington is fundamentally corrupt. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible.
Made in America, heard round the world. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I'm Chuck Woolery, along with my co-host Mark Young. And we have a great guest today. But before we get to our guest, Mark.
Yes.
Oh, Chuck,
Mark was a disappointing co-host.
I know. I just vanished. So, Chuck, here's kind of what we're going to be doing over the next several months.
Yeah.
What we're going to be working on is not only are we going to be doing some in-depth looks at the candidates.
Right.
Because
in various states, different states around the country.
Right. So we're going to take a look. We're going to do some in-depth look at the people that are running for president on the Democratic ticket. We're even going to take a look at the one percenters. You know, it's funny because Bernie Sanders hates the one percenters, but now the Democratic ticket is filled with one percenters. Which, of course, is people who can only get 1% of the vote. But at any rate, and we're going to start working on some of the local elections because we focus on the presidential race, but we need to secure the Senate. We need to get the Senate up to a 60-60 majority.
Yep.
And we need to flip the House back.
Yes,
we need to get rid of people like Ilhan Omar and AOC and what's her name, Rashid. And I mean, I could go through the whole list of who we need to get rid of in the Congress.
The ones who are pro-Iranian, you mean?
You're a racist.
I am a racist.
You know that. You're a racist.
Well, it's the Hezbollah caucus.
Beautifully put.
Folks, the voice you just heard there is none other than Dr. Gavin Clarkson. Dr. Gavin Clarkson is a Harvard PhD who will be running for an open Senate seat in New Mexico. And you're running for a seat that is currently held by a Democrat, correct, Doctor?
Correct. It's the Democrat Tom Udall is retiring, and so this is an open seat. In fact, it's the only open seat that the Democrats are having to defend this year, and so I'm running to flip that open seat over to the Republicans in 2020.
So, Gavin, this is really a very simple question. It's usually what I ask of all of my contestants on television when I talk to them. But I'm expecting a longer answer from you and a more in-depth answer for you, and that is, tell us about yourself and your family.
Well, I am an enrolled tribal member. I was actually the first tribal member ever to get a doctorate from the Harvard Business School, but I'm definitely not a fancy elitist because I am the only doctoral graduate in the entire history of the Harvard Business School that is also placed in a livestock show.
Now, you and Elizabeth Warren have a lot in common then, right?
Well, I got my doctorate, I also did get a law degree over across the river at the Harvard Law School. I was president of the Native American Law Students Association, and I did confront Elizabeth Warren on at least three separate occasions about her lack of support for American Indian students. Oh, yeah. I'm a light-skinned Indian. I'm pigmentationally challenged. So I'm, you know, she should have felt. she would have felt fairly comfortable as another light-skinned Oklahoma Indian if she actually had been one.
Yeah, right.
My father started out as an orphan Indian kid in Chickasha, Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl days of the Depression. And he was so broke. And he would tell you he was broke and not poor, because poor is a state of mind,
right,
whereas broke is merely a temporary insufficiency of cash flow. Mm-hmm. But he was so broke that he was literally digging through other Indians' garbage cans for food. And in 1943, he decided two things. He was sick and tired of poverty, and he was mad at the Japanese for bombing Pearl Harbor. So he joined the Navy and never looked back. And by 1948, my father was the first American Indian to fly a jet. He was flying F-9F Panther jets off the USS Princeton. And by 1962, he had become the senior nuclear targeting strategist for all of NATO.
Holy
so I am God. Proof positive that Indian poverty is not a life sentence.
Yeah, it's amazing how ingenuity and self-awareness and the ability to climb out of poverty is available to anyone who that wants to do it, that just has a desire to do it.
I don't want to sell my mom short either. My mother also is a tribal member, came up from abject poverty, managed to buy a one-way ticket to Paris, France, where she got a job as a DIA analyst. So my parents actually met as spies in Paris. My dad was naval intelligence. My mom was DIA. And my mom was one of the first people to identify China as a strategic threat. She was writing a brief on the Chinese nuclear capability.
How long ago was that?
1962. So my parents' first date was a discussion of centrifuges and uranium hexafluoride, which apparently explains a lot about me.
That sounds like an outing with me, doesn't it?
Personality.
But no, so both of my parents are you know, basically came from abject poverty, but didn't let that hold them back. And both of them ended up getting advanced degrees. So they also insisted, they were very, they emphasized education all the time. That was my escape. That was their escape to make sure that we did not end up in cycles of poverty.
Let me ask you this question. How did they afford that kind of education?
Well, in my father's case, it was the GI Bill in the Navy. And in my mom's case, she's just stinking brilliant. And so is mostly scholarships.
Mm-hmm. So Chuck, you can, if somebody wanted to get a college education today, uh-huh, they could still join the military and get a college education, couldn't they?
I don't think the GI Bill is still active, is it? I mean, I really don't.
Oh, yeah, no, there's definitely money for college in the military.
I could have gone on the GI Bill because I was in the Navy.
No, it's still available.
So it's still available to all of these people who join the military. I did not know that.
So when you hear Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren talk about how we need free college, we still have a program for free college now. Mm-hmm. It's called the military, except these are people that hate the military.
Right. Well, and so I'm second generation Navy. My father was 26 years. I was in for 2.5 years, and unfortunately, my career got cut short with a head-on collision with a drunk driving illegal alien. But that's a different story for a different day. But it's absolutely true that the military provides a great option. It is the great leveler of all people. You walk in, and they don't care what color you are. They don't care where you came from. They basically just care: can you do the job? Can you act professionally? And can you defend this country, taking that oath to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic?
You know, that's interesting because I follow politics. I follow, you know, this kind of stuff every day, probably more than most, probably more than Mark, really, in a way. And he's very avid about it. I did not know that education was still available through like a GI Bill or whatever it is to our military. So that's a message that needs to get out.
Well, and also,
and I'm sure that most people aren't even aware of that.
And the military provides tremendous training while you're in the military. It's not just the college education. And by the way, I'm a college professor, but I can tell you the college education is highly overrated. More than half of what we teach is totally useless. Now, I'm in a business school, so I'm hoping that I'm teaching the useful half, but I also teach vocational education. I'm a big fan of the skilled trades because every healthy economy needs people who can build and fix and make and raise and grow things. And for far too long, the bi-coastal elitists have looked down their noses at people who work with their hands every day. And yet as somebody who has changed the wax ring on a toilet, I can tell you there's a really serious reason why a plumber makes way more money than a poet does.
Okay. I am part of that group. Unfortunately, I was. When I was in high school, we had manual arts, which is the same thing. It was vocational training. And every kid who was in manual arts was looked down upon by the rest of the people in school and high school as, oh, well, that's all they can do.
Right.
And it's very unfortunate. And I count myself among those who were kind of elitist in that way, only to find out later on in life, these are the people who literally keep our country running. And these are the skills that have, you know, that lack that we need. And I know a lot of those kids who were in manual arts who went on to become millionaires.
I know, by the way, Chuck's been at my house. I remember I was at my house, you were at our house one day. Mm-hmm. And Sal had bought a new light fixture. And I jumped up on a ladder and I yanked the light off and I put a new light fixture up. And Chuck goes, "What are you doing?" "I'm installing a light fixture." "You know how to do that?"
Well, he didn't even interview it before he did it. He just did it.
I didn't even turn the power off.
Well, and you probably didn't ask about its feelings either.
No, I did not. I actually grew up in the trades. I was one of those kids that the Woolerys would have been looking down upon.
Yeah, I mean, I it wasn't my family. It was me, and I have to admit that I was part of that group. I wasn't vocal about it. It just was an attitude that, like, you know, I guess it's...
Well, the energy sector is a big deal in New Mexico. It's the only part of our economy that's keeping the entire state afloat. It comes out of about four different counties. And so I teach some vocational classes up at the College of Energy. And again, you know, if you drive your car, I mean, now that America is a net energy exporter, the oil that came out of the ground came from somebody who's a skilled tradesman. You know, that's a great opportunity for young men and women to be able to get a job. And in many cases, it's the best paying job in your home community.
There's some great
I was in Northeastern Kentucky in Ashland, Simmet Salvey, which was the coke producer. Ashland Oil and Refining Company was right there. Armco Steel was there. I came from the same kind of community you did. It was all industrial based.
Yeah, my uncle still has oil wells in New Mexico.
Well, yeah, of course, your uncle's rich.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there is that. But
well, you should tell him to go to GavinClarkson.com and hit the donate button.
So let me ask a question. So you're at Harvard. You're a Harvard professor.
Yes. Well, I wasn't a professor at Harvard. I did my undergrad and my MBA at Rice University, and then I did my law degree and my doctorate at Harvard. The joke is I went to Rice University four times. I went to the real Rice twice, and then I went to the Rice of the Northeast twice, but nobody at Harvard thought that was funny.
I don't even understand it. I think it's funny.
I also noticed you've been over at University of Michigan also.
Yes, I ran the I was in the School of Information with a joint appointment in Native American Studies, and in the law school I ran the Indian Law program at the University of Michigan for about 5 years.
Excellent. That was my own school. So tell us about your relationship with Elizabeth Warren, being that you're both Native Americans and all, and both tied to Harvard.
She has at least now admitted that she's not a tribal member and has no actual connection to an actual tribe.
Well, she was caught. Let's be honest. DNA caught her.
And it's interesting. She actually, one of the tribes that I was working with when she was doing her Senate campaign, she threw them under the bus. It was the Delaware Nation. She threw them under the bus because, well, I could prove it, except for they suck at record keeping. And nobody's calling her on that. By the way, I do have to take issue with the president. She is – the proper term to refer to her is not Pocahontas, because Pocahontas was a real person. The proper term is Focahontas, because she's totally fake.
Yeah, I think that's what he says. I'm not
sure. Yeah, and I always call her Liawatha. Yeah, I use Liawatha when I
– But anyway, it was interesting. So I was president of the Native American Law Students Association. We invited her since I was doing my law degree and my doctorate simultaneously. I was there for 5 years, and we invited her every year to come support Native students, because we were a small group. We were not having some of the other schools were doing much better at recruiting the Native students, so we didn't have a large community. And I reached out to her in person, personally invited her three separate times. The last time it was actually I was the Lewis Fellow for Law Teaching. I'd finished my law degree, and I had picked up a fellowship at the Harvard Law School. And while I was finishing my doctorate, and it turned out that it was illegal for me to get my doctorate at the Harvard Business School, because the law school is in Cambridge, but the business school is in Boston. And according to the Indian Imprisonment Act of 1675, it was illegal for an American Indian to enter the city of Boston without two armed militia escorts. And because Harvard was a gun-free zone, I would have had to ditch my armed escorts at the guard booth. So I literally was breaking the law every time I sat in class unescorted. And I raised this issue with her and said, you know, gee, this might be something that you could, you know, get behind and, you know, and raise the awareness. And she blew us off.
You know, it's a typical Democrat kind of response, though. They will use any kind of minority to advance their own cause, but they really aren't interested in them.
And this is back when she was still claiming to be Native American.
Oh, yeah. This is after she had put it on her bar card. This is after she had listed herself in the faculty directory of in the minority law professors section as an American Indian law professor. I mean, it was told to us that, oh, we do have one American Indian on the faculty. It's Elizabeth Warren. And we all go, well, you know, okay, maybe she's a light-skinned Oklahoma Indian, but you know, she blew us off completely, never once showed up. Never lifted a finger to help Harvard do a better job of recruiting American Indian students, when in fact Harvard was founded the way that they raised money to found the original university. It was to educate the Christian children and the Indians.
So your state, New Mexico, you have a large population of Native Americans, right?
Yeah, about 10% of the voters in New Mexico are tribal members. The largest tribe is the Navajo Nation, and then you've got two reservations of Apaches with the Mescalero and the Hickory Apache. The Fort Sill Apache from Oklahoma have a little bit of land to the west of where I live, and then the rest are the Pueblos that are predominantly up and down the Rio Grande.
So, are they sympathetic to you as a candidate?
Well, the answer is yes, and that's one of the reasons why there's a lot of excitement about my candidacy, because I did run statewide in the last election as a replacement candidate. The woman who was running for Secretary of State had to drop out for family reasons, and so the party nominated me and appointed me as the Secretary of State candidate. I got in late. I really only had about 2 months to campaign, but I carried 25% of the Navajo Nation when no Republican had ever been able to get more than 5%. And I've been doing tribal economic development in New Mexico for 20 years, and I did serve in the Trump administration. I was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy and Economic Development, and that included Indian Affairs, a portfolio of a multi-billion dollar oil and gas portfolio, as well as a program that helped various tribes around the country fire the Bureau of Indian Affairs and take over their own governmental operations.
So since I'm a little unfamiliar with New Mexico politics, as probably most people who live outside of New Mexico are, I'm assuming anyway, that is it mostly a Democrat state, or is it kind of split down the middle? What are the biggest obstacles you have to face and overcome?
Well, it was historically a purple state. We did have a bit of a blue tsunami in 2018 for, in some sense, more sort of local party politic reasons, and the fact that there were some issues where some Republicans just stayed home on election day 2018. What that did, however, was allow the radical progressives to take over the Democrat Party, and they have subsequently proceeded to drive it into the farthest left edge of the ditch you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Every one of my opponents, I don't have a Republican opponent. I'm unopposed in the primary. But there are three Democrats on the other side. They're all in for the Green New Deal, for Medicare for All. But the issues that have really turned off some of the more socially conservative New Mexicans are their support of late-term abortion, including abortion up until the day of birth. And this was something where they really went crazy and decided that they were going to, if a doctor or a nurse wanted to, for reasons of conscience, decline to perform an abortion, they were actually trying to advance legislation that would pull their medical license. What happened was, because this came to the floor of the House, they were forced to admit that they supported the existing policy of abortion up until the day of birth for any reason or for no reason. And in fact, it also came out that it was the official state policy at the University of New Mexico Hospital that if a baby survives an abortion attempt, their official position is to toss it in the sink and watch it die. And that is a level of depravity that most New Mexicans had no idea that that's what Democrats stood for in New Mexico. You couple that with an attempt to confiscate all the firearms and tell everybody, oh, gee, you just should store your firearms at the sheriff's office. And that prompted 30 of the 33 counties to pass Second Amendment sanctuary county resolutions. So you have a big walkaway movement in New Mexico of former Democrats who are socially conservative, who believe in the Second Amendment, who oppose abortion up until the day of birth. They may disagree about earlier the pregnancy, but they are universally opposed to late-term abortion and killing babies on their birthday. And those are the Democrats that are going to flip over and either drop their registration and become independents. Some of them are switching over to the Republican Party. But those are the people that I'm going to be reaching out to take this seat and flip this seat over in 2020. And you also, in addition to being a tribal member, in addition to being somebody who ran a Christian crisis pregnancy center when I was in grad school and a lifetime member of the NRA, I'm also a fluent Spanish speaker. And I'm married to a legal immigrant. My wife, her family has a history of fleeing tyranny and socialism. Her father's side of the family fled Mussolini in World War II. The mother's side of the family fled Franco in Spain right after World War II, and they all moved to Argentina, where they encountered more
communist.
Absolutely. Then they encountered more statism and socialism in Argentina. So they left. The mom went to Venezuela, and then had to reflee. Yeah, they had to reflee when Hugo Chavez took over. But my wife, 26 years ago, went to Mexico took her a year. She worked odd jobs, actually sold gold door to door in Puebla, Mexico, to earn enough money to be able to go through the paperwork process, came to the United States legally. She crossed over in a truck that was half filled with turkeys, but she came here legally. She didn't speak a lick of English. She got a work permit. She learned English by listening to country music while cleaning other people's houses. It took her 14 years to become a citizen, and she is now one of the nation's leading medical estheticians. She is the quintessential example of the American immigrant success story, and she followed the rules. I say that my father-in-law, she didn't sponsor my father-in-law. He qualified on his own as a skilled tradesman. He's a specialist in Italian shoe designs, and a company in Texas was looking to bring on somebody who specialized in Italian shoe designs. Gucci, so he qualified on his own. So everybody in my family that has come here came here legally. They followed the rules, and I live on the border, and we are being totally overrun by people who are gaming the system, cheating the system, engaging in asylum fraud. You know, if you forget your small child, the cartel will rent you one. And it's an absolute disaster. And our governor, it's absolutely insane. She claimed that there was no crisis to justify pulling the National Guard off the border. And she's now suing the president because of the crisis.
Typical Democrat. It's just typical progressivism. I wish more people around the country could actually see it and understand it for what it is. And that's our battle all the time, is to try to expose the hypocrisy that permeates the progressive Democrat Party.
If it wasn't for double standards, the radical left would have no standards at all.
Not at all. Now, Chuck, I'm just thinking here. Gavin's wife learned English listening to country music. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming early on she thought everyone had a pickup truck, their wife was leaving them, and they had a dog with one eye, probably. But
when I took her to New Mexico, she said, "This can't be America because it's there's no rain, because all the country songs have rain in them too."
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
But it's interesting. There was actually a story about the two when we got married last November, and we got married in D.C. and it was an interesting experience because we went into the D.C. Marriage Bureau. I showed them my New Mexico driver's license, and the clerk looked at it and she said, "I'm sorry, I'll be back." I figured it was just because it was an out-of-state driver's license. 10 minutes later, she comes back and she says, "I'm sorry, sir, but my supervisor says that we cannot accept international driver's licenses. Do you have your New Mexico passport handy?"
International.
And, yes. Oh, no. And so my wife and I are looking at each other. We go, "No, it's a state. It's that vacant lot between Texas and Arizona. We speak English there." And
I kid you not,
the clerk looked me right in the eye and says, "Oh, sir, that's not the problem. Your English is excellent."
So and my wife, from Mexico.
Yes. And so.
It's the newer part of it.
Yes. Yeah, so, and, I've had people say, "Well, I don't care how new it is, it's still Mexico." But the clerk, we had the
57 states.
Yes. Well, actually, it's a joke that one of our 50 is missing. And in this case, she went back, and 10 minutes later, she comes back. Meanwhile, everybody behind us in line is laughing their butts off. She comes back and she says, "Okay, you're right. We looked it up. Google says you're a state."
Oh, my gosh.
And so I did the little funny Facebook post of ha ha ha.
This is the administrative state that we all depend on.
Yes. And so I did a little Facebook post, and then our local newspaper picked it up, and they did, they went to check the story because it seems like it's an Onion type story.
Exactly.
And so they actually checked with the D.C. Marriage Bureau, and the D.C. Marriage Bureau sent back a snarky, passive-aggressive apology.
Yeah, right.
Saying, "We apologize for ignoring New Mexico's 106-year history as a state." So the newspaper printed their apology in full, and USA Today picked it up and ran it on the front page.
They didn't
and then
they didn't
all the TVs, all the, so if you Google New Mexico passport, it's the story of me and my wife. It went worldwide. Her Italian family in Italy saw it on Italian television because we did an interview with Telemundo in Spanish. It was hilarious. And so our wedding video has been viewed about 50,000 times now. But that's part of the reason I'm running for the Senate, is to make sure that D.C. never forgets about New Mexico again.
So you were talking, I'm gonna get serious on you here for a minute. You were talking about all these Democrat politicians in New Mexico, which are for late term abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And first off, the idea that you would remove a doctor's license because he doesn't want to murder a baby is, I don't even know what word to describe that with.
Barbaric.
And barbaric, yes.
But my question to you is, why do you think these people want this type of abortion? What's going on in their heads or heart, in your opinion, that would make anyone want late-term abortion rights?
Well, there are some people, unfortunately, who have been sold on the notion that it's just a lump of tissue, and so if it's not perfect, they kill it. Iceland brags about the fact that they have eliminated Down syndrome through abortion. Mm-hmm. China used abortion to enforce its one-child policy. The number of times that people have a late-term abortion, and in fact, New Mexico is the late-term abortion capital of the Western Hemisphere. We have had people who fly in as tourists to New Mexico simply because our doctors will perform an abortion that nobody else in the Western Hemisphere will perform. It's disgusting.
Really?
Yes.
What is that? Is it more late-term abortions?
Well, no, we have doctors who advertise in all throughout the world that come to New Mexico and we will kill your baby for you.
Good night.
I mean, here's the thing I don't understand. I'll ask this to both of you. At what point of a pregnancy do you change your mind? I mean, you're 6 months into a pregnancy, 7 months into it, and now you decide, you know what? I don't think I want to. Didn't you have a lot of time to decide that earlier?
Wait a minute. Yeah, let's go back to Northrum in Virginia, who was a pediatrician. And his whole explanation was the baby will be delivered, we'll make it comfortable, and then we'll talk with the mother and decide whether we kill it or not.
Well, we'll use Kamala Harris language. We'll have a conversation.
Yeah. Right. Well, and that is the policy at the University of New Mexico Hospital today. If a baby survives an abortion attempt, they toss it in the sink and watch it die.
Who promoted this?
Planned Parenthood.
How about the governor?
The governor is all in for late-term abortion. That's one of her issues. And again, this is pandering to the radical left. This is them trying to, they're trying to be out leftist of each other. And if you look at all the evil totalitarian regimes around the world, they have used abortion as eugenics. And again, as a native person, the notion of denying personhood has been used against many groups, American Indians, Blacks, Jews. I mean, denying people personhood has been used as a tool to kill them. That's what the Nazis used in the Holocaust.
It's amazing. So, who's the woman who started Planned Parenthood? What's her name?
Margaret Sanger.
Margaret Sanger.
And she was a notorious eugenicist. And in fact, there's a tribe in upstate Vermont called the Abenaki.
What eugenicist means, because a lot of people don't know. I don't mean to condescend to our audience.
Well, actually, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has a quote in the New York Times talking about a 1980 decision where she was surprised that Medicaid wouldn't pay for abortions because she said, my understanding was there's a whole bunch of people that we didn't want to have babies.
Okay.
So basically,
Sanger literally said, we're trying to get rid of the black population. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to eradicate them, basically.
Yeah, her goal was to keep black people from reproducing. Okay. She also had colleagues who wanted to keep American Indians from reproducing.
And she was a fan of Hitler.
Okay. All right.
Putting all that in perspective, this is one of the heroes of Hillary Clinton, so it's one of the heroes of the left. Okay? Will we agree on that?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And they're all for Planned Parenthood, who Margaret Sanger started. So how do they explain this to people when you talk about how does the black community even associate with Democrats when they know that and Hillary Clinton and people like that, when they know that their primary purpose in the beginning was to get rid of them? I cannot get my head around that.
I can give you the answer they use. The answer they use is that the organization has evolved.
Oh, well, everybody evolves, right?
Well, but the media refuses to call them on that issue. And the other thing the media will never do is they will never ask a Democrat, well, how far along is too far along in a pregnancy before you have a problem killing the baby? And so that was that was a brilliant political jujitsu move that Rand Paul did in the 2016 election, was basically say, go ask Debbie Wasserman Schultz, how far along is too far along before you would support some restrictions on abortion. Now, obviously, saving the mother's life is a critical issue, but what you find is that in the late term, it's actually medically safer for the woman to have a C-section than it is to kill the baby in the womb and then force a delivery of a stillborn baby. it's actually safer at the end of the pregnancy to have a C-section. So late-term abortion is never medically necessary, ever.
Well, they also try to use rape and incest as one of the big reasons. Well, first off, you kind of know if you're a victim of rape or incest. You don't need to wait 9 months to find that out. But statistically, rape and incest doesn't even come close to 1% of all abortions that are performed.
So it's, well, again, what I say, they take the minority position, elevate it to the majority, and everybody thinks that's it. And it's not real.
Well, and this is what I focus on is the notion of personhood. Basically, you know, there are people who have a range of opinions, but we all, if we can start at the point where we all agree that it's wrong to kill a baby on its birthday, that baby is a person. And then we start talking about, okay, well, if it's a person at 9 months of gestation, you know, is it a person at 8 months of gestation? And most people would say that, you know, that given that you have babies that are born after only 22 weeks of gestation that leave the hospital perfectly healthy, you know, certainly medical science has pushed the envelope far earlier than the Supreme Court understood in Roe versus Wade. And a lot of it is we're starting to have the younger generations, the millennials and the Gen Zers, who are becoming more and more pro-life because of things like 4D ultrasounds. You cannot look at a 4D ultrasound of a little baby and say, oh, that's just a clump of flesh, you know, the clump of cells.
Now, these
so
are the
part of it
people,
is that medical science is forcing people to realize that Planned Parenthood has been lying to them for decades.
You know, these are the same people, by the way. Go ahead, Chuck.
There are three things that Democrats absolutely depend on to get elected and to govern. They have to reject history. They have to reject responsibility and reason. And they have to completely ignore reality. Those three things are the keys to their success. And it's just amazing to me that they continually get elected with those three fundamental things going against them, and they use them as a positive.
Well, as somebody who's been in a university setting, I've been teaching since 1991 at the university level. I've noticed this. It is clear that the left is trying to use university campuses as a field of indoctrination. The level of math ability is diminishing. You know, and so basically, the moment the kids can't do the math, they can't run the numbers and see that the left is promising something that is totally unaffordable. They don't. The university used to be a marketplace of ideas, and now it's like the old Soviet Union, where all you do is stand in line for the one thing, and that one thing is the standard socialist drivel. The amount of free exchange of ideas has been totally squashed. I mean, I was on leave at the university to go serve in the Trump administration, which they had to sort of, you know, hold their breath and choke on, because the notion of a college professor going to work for the Trump administration was bad enough. But then, literally, the day. Oh, yes, you know, I'm a traitor to my people as a tribal member for joining the Trump administration, but at least according to the left. But then the day before I announced that I was running for office, there was an email between my department head and the provost saying, oh, Gavin's not coming back for another 18 months. And then the day after I announced, the day I announced, they said, oh, gosh, we're going to have to fire him. So, you know, I was an endangered species. I was a Christian, conservative, pro-life, pro-business, pro-gun, pro-Israel Republican college professor. Some people might even say that's a unicorn.
It's a unicorn.
But, you know, but basically the moment I actually outed myself as a Republican, I mean, they actually tried to fire me for going to the Trump inauguration. The left, just like the Democrats put together that fake Russian dossier that dragged the country through this nonsense for the last 2 years. The radical leftists on the faculty put together a fake dossier on me to try and get me fired. They accused me of plagiarism, except for the only person they could find that I had allegedly plagiarized was me. So, you know, but that they used that to try and get me fired, and that failed. And so, but then right after I announced for office, they basically said, well, gee, we're going to cancel your leave and we're going to do all these bad things to you, but we're not going to make you drop out. I said, well, I'm sorry, but the rule of law applies to partisan Democrats, even if you don't like the outcome. And they said, well, you're being insubordinate. And so then they fired me. So I, of course, am suing them, and I will crush them. And, you know, and that process will go along. Because basically, the federal judge actually has already ruled that I have a very credible claim for denial of due process. So I have a civil rights complaint going against the university.
So you were not a tenured professor.
No, I had university to go on leave. I was supposed to go up for tenure right when I got back.
Blue Emu works fast and you won't stink. This episode of Blunt Force Truth is brought to you by Blue Emu Pain Relief Products. Now, I've been in show business for many years now, and I'm not slowing down, but I can use a little help every now and then. Blue Emu's family of products are made in America and have become a staple in my life. The deep penetrating formula of Blue Emu Original is best for supporting my muscles and joints, and I'm sure you've seen it. It's on the shelf in a blue and white jar. I also use Maximum Arthritis for any arthritic pain and the Lidocaine Cream for numbing pain relief. Not only do these Blue Emu formulas work great, there's no chill, no burn, and no odor. Blue Emu, it works fast and you won't stink. Available at Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Amazon, and other fine retailers. So we were talking about tenure and you being not being a tenured professor.
Right. So I had switched from a law school over to the business school. So my tenure clock had to restart when I moved to New Mexico State. And so I was actually going to go up for tenure after I came back from the administration. But they decided, oh, gee, we're going to fire him now. You know, again, it's one of those things where there is very little tolerance in academia for conservative thought. They just don't want us to exist. They want to, you know, like I said, I'm an endangered species.
Well, it's the same way with the left everywhere. The media doesn't, you know, want any part of it. Listen, there are a lot of people in Washington on our side who really don't want to hear about conservatives. They have no time for them, no use for them. So it's an uphill battle that we fight. It really is.
And well, let's catch up with some of your platform. So
okay.
So let me start. We know where you're sitting on abortion. Where are you sitting on the border?
Well, I am for border enforcement. I live on the border, inside the border exclusion zone. I'm very pro-immigrant. I'm obviously married to an immigrant. And as I tell people, la mitad de mis compañeros en mi campaña son hijos o nietos de inmigrantes legales. And nobody expects me to be able to speak Spanish. But the same conversation we're having right now, I can have the exact same conversation in Spanish. And interestingly, my likely opponent in the Democrat Party doesn't speak Spanish, even though his last name is Lujan. So that'll be interesting when I challenge him to a debate in Spanish. It's interesting. In this race, the Republican is the tribal member who's a fluent Spanish speaker, married to a legal immigrant who followed the rules, whose primary expertise is rural and tribal economic development, helping elevate people out of abject poverty using freedom and capitalism.
Okay, let me give you a little thing that you can do, okay? And you should do this. I'm not telling you what to do, but just a suggestion. I wouldn't say anything about speaking Spanish. I wouldn't challenge him to do it in Spanish. I would, while I'm in the middle of the debate, however far down you want to pick your moment, the moderator asks you a question and you answer it in fluent Spanish. And no one will understand you. And you look to your opponent for a response and say, oh, you don't speak your language. I see. But I do.
Well, you know, I'm sure we'll choreograph some moments. We, you know, that is the advantage I have is as a university professor, as a college professor, you know, the intellectual debate is something I look forward to and enjoy. And
then you can translate for him.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But my number one issue is jobs. New Mexico is the only state in the Southwest that's shrinking. We're the worst economy in the country.
Why?
We've had Democrats in control for 90 years of our state legislature and we are the most business unfriendly state in the country. A friend of mine has a movie theater, and the health department was actually trying to make the kids serving the popcorn get food handler licenses. They're regulating us. I mean, the number of businesses that have gone out of business because they're jacking up the minimum wage. In New Mexico, there are companies in the oil and gas space that they set up shop right across the border in Texas because they don't want to be, they don't mind providing services in New Mexico, but they don't want to be headquartered in New Mexico. Yeah. 95% of my students leave the state when they graduate. It's a really bad situation. And you talked earlier about reaching out to those socially conservative Democrats and independents. My vision for New Mexico is not inherently partisan. Imagine a New Mexico where we raise up our kids, we send them off to school, whether it be college or whether it be trade school. Because again, every healthy economy needs people who can build and fix and make and raise and grow things. But We send them off to school, and then they come back. They come back home to where they grew up, and they get a good paying job there, and they raise their children in New Mexico, and we get to watch our grandbabies rodeo and do Little League on the weekend. That is a vision of New Mexico that I think all New Mexicans can get behind, regardless of party affiliation.
And New Mexico is a beautiful state. In fact, I plan on being there late August, early September, because I'm going to do some motorcycle riding.
I had a lot of people who are friends of mine in Los Angeles who retired to Mexico.
Oh, unfortunately, we have had an import of Californians, and that's, you know, unfortunately, people leave California for all the reasons that it's totally, you know, that California has totally gone off the left
same
coast.
Thing in Texas, where I'm
and then at. and then they move to New Mexico and they forget why they left California and they bring their crazy politics with them.
I spoke with a guy last week when I was at a convention, and it was a gentleman who was there from Boise, Idaho. And he was telling me that real estate values in Boise, Idaho are up 60% from the crazy West Coast people that are coming into Boise. And as he said, and bringing all their nuttiness with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you imagine how people felt about me when I moved to Texas? I mean, they didn't know that I was conservative. They had no clue.
Like a college professor, you have probably had to keep that under wraps while you're in Hollywood.
Oh, listen, I'll tell you the truth, Gavin. This is exactly how bad it was. And I'm going back to the 70s and 80s. I couldn't breathe a word to anyone of my political convictions. I couldn't do it, because if I did, I wouldn't work. It was that simple.
Mm-hmm. I committed academic suicide by joining the Trump administration. I fully understand. Mm-hmm.
So has this president been a friend or a foe or a non-issue for Native Americans?
Well, it's a mixed bag, obviously, and it's not. I mean, the president wants to elevate people out of poverty. He wants to propagate freedom, and he wants government off their back. And most Indian country, they're sick and tired of the federal government running things. My son's got a T-shirt that says, "Sure, you could trust the federal government, just ask an Indian." Mm-hmm. So you know, the president's agenda of creating jobs and bringing jobs back to America. Is certainly something that resonates with Indian country, because again, so, you know, some of the tribes I work with, unemployment is at 85%, and 90% of the people that have a job are still below the poverty level. So I think the president's record is unfinished in Indian country. I think there's a lot of good that can be done. I think American energy dominance is something that Indian country can play a big part of. You've got a lot of tribes in the oil and gas sector. You've got tribes with massive coal resources, and the Obama administration just destroyed those tribes, destroyed their economies.
Totally anti-fossil fuel, as the Democrats are. They're totally anti-fossil fuel.
So, but at the same point, you know, this notion of supporting the skilled trades and in vocational education, I mean, that's something where, you know, we need to have vibrant tribal economies. And one of my major components, it's kind of nerdy, but it's basically, it's something I developed when I was working for the Trump administration. We were looking at it using regulations to do it, or a regulatory fix to do it, and we decided that it was going to be better doing it legislatively, which is part of why I'm running for office. But I'm a tribal member. Chuck, I'm going to assume that you're not a tribal member. You and I go to a reservation and we both open up the same business. You and I will both pay taxes to the tribe because it's their land. But the state of New Mexico will add an additional tax on you just because you're a white guy. Mm-hmm. For no other reason than that. It's an activist Supreme Court case called Cotton Petroleum that started out in New Mexico. And it basically has – and there were the first two presidents to talk about this. The first one was George Washington. He said that states should not be interfering in tribal economies. But after this case came out, Ronald Reagan had a presidential commission on reservation economies, and he said that double taxation was the death of tribal economies, and he was right. So I figure if my primary economic platform is something that both George Washington and Ronald Reagan were in favor of, it's probably a pretty good idea. And the advantage is, as a pointy-headed academic, I had a room full of economists at the Department of Interior helping me run through the numbers, and we collected all the data. And if you eliminated this race-based taxation system, this double taxation on job creators in Indian country, it's a $2 billion stimulus for New Mexico. It's a $40 billion stimulus for the entire country, and it does not cost the taxpayers a single dime. It is the best of everything. It's a tax cut for job creators in the poorest areas of our country, and that helps elevate everybody. And also, you know, people who live off reservation still subsidize poverty on the reservation. So it's good for everybody. There's nobody who loses. And it's something that, that's one of my major platforms, is eliminating double taxation on job creators in our poorest parts of our country.
Now, how do you do that as a U.S. senator? Because that's really a state issue, right?
Well, actually, no. Indian policy is federal. It's been so since the Constitution. In fact, that was something that George Washington established. And so basically what you say is, you know, that states get to tax activity within the states, tribes get to tax activity within the tribes, and never the two shall mix.
So you would write a bill to put on the floor to stop that?
It's a one sentence fix that basically says that each sovereign can only tax within the land and within which it exerces sovereignty.
Okay. Oh, my friend!
I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry to feel like you're being misled, but a one sentence fix will never work in Washington.
Well, I was about to say it won't be one sentence.
Well,
45 or 50 pages.
Well, okay, I'll put a whole bunch of preamble and put all the data in there to show why it's a good idea. But again, I mean, it makes perfect sense. People in Texas don't tax Louisiana. Louisiana doesn't get to tax Texas. So, you know, so why should a state where it provide, you know, tax an area where it provides absolutely no services, no nothing? You know, why should it be taxing job creators there and in turn destroying that economy?
No, so, you're right. So how do these Democrats get away with this with the people? How do they justify that?
Well, again, a lot of it is state revenue offices in Democrat states that they've never seen a tax that they don't want to increase.
No, I'm talking about in New Mexico.
Well, again, the radical left takeover is very new. You know, Democrats in New Mexico used to be reasonable. There used to be socially conservative Democrats, but I mean, just in the same way, nationally, the radical left is launching primary campaigns against any remaining pro-life Democrat. The socialists in the Democratic Party have actually even driven New Mexico almost as far left as California.
Well, boy, California is I use California as a model of what the Democrats want for the rest of the United States.
Because, well, instead of creating New Mexico, now they're trying to create new Venezuela.
Well, in order to do that, and we covered this on our last podcast, in order to achieve this, they have to get rid of the middle class. They have to, because the middle class is not dependent on government.
Right. Well, and that's part of what they're, I mean, New Mexico has the highest percentage of people on public assistance. And that is because the radical left has continually done everything they can.
That's the perfect model for socialism.
To destroy the economy, make more people dependent on government, so then they can hand out the free stuff and say, oh, look at me. You know, you should vote for me because I'll give you free stuff. As opposed to, how about let's give everybody freedom instead of free stuff?
So New Mexico is that poverty stricken?
Yes.
How many people live in New Mexico?
It's about 2.5 million.
Okay, so it's a relatively unpopulated state.
It has three congressional seats. Obviously, two U.S. senators. I'm running for one of those too. But again, in the United States Senate, you know, every state gets two votes. So that's why even your viewers that are not in New Mexico need to be coming to support my campaign at GavinClarkson.com, because we need to put more strong constitutional conservatives in the U.S. Senate. Because that's the last bulwark against the nonsense that's coming out of the House.
It's basically what the Democrats and Republicans are against, are constitutional conservative Republicans. Amazing to me, but anyway, it happens.
Oh, it's mind-numbing.
Yeah, it is.
What is going on there?
So what are you going to target that the Democrats push as reasonable and legitimate on their side when we know that it won't be? But what do you target that they can persuade people with? Do you ever look at their arguments and say, okay, this is what worked with them, and this is how they persuaded people to vote for them, so this is where I need to attack and explain and renew a conservative approach to a, you know, functional government, which obviously you don't have now. So how do you do that?
Well, the Democrats have no good ideas. For the most part, the radical left, certainly the radical left has no good ideas. There are some bipartisan ideas, you know, that I would obviously be supportive of, you know, when those opportunities present themselves. But the one thing the left does do is they connect with people emotionally. And we need to do a better job on our side of taking our better ideas and doing a better job of reaching people at an emotional level about, I mean, take for example, the notion of freedom. If you want to get somebody really emotional, take away their iPhone and force them to use an Android, or take their Android away and force them to use an iPhone. That is the epitome of a denial of freedom. Say, look, I'm the government. I'm smarter than you. You get to pick the phone that I want. Half the country is going to say, oh, I don't like that phone. But so what freedom is a chance to pick your own phone interface. And that is an emotional connection that people have to their digital devices that we can use to explain why freedom is the better option rather than government control.
You know, I always like to use the example of Russia, the old Soviet Union. When you look at the cars that they manufactured for their people, as opposed to the cars we manufactured for our people, have you ever seen their cars?
Only in movies.
Oh, my God. I mean, they
look like shoeboxes.
They're horrible. Mm-hmm. And it's such a simple example of what you get from government and what you get from private enterprise. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. it's so easy to see. Anyone can see that example. And mm-hmm. I think that if you're going to connect with people emotionally, you got to connect with what they drive, where they live, what they eat, how they communicate, their families. I mean, you have a great argument for the family, which is what, you know, Democrats always use, lie about it, but you have a great argument for the family emotionally.
Right. Because that most people, I was blessed to grow up with grandma at home. I am a better man because of my grandma's wisdom. And I am trying to create a New Mexico where extended family networks are still viable, where people can, where young people can get a job in their home communities so that their children get to play with their grandparents. That, you know, that we've that's it. That's that is part of the reason that the social fabric of our country has been torn apart so badly is because we have lost those family connections. We don't have those extended family networks where grandma's wisdom helps make the grandchildren better.
Well, Chuck, when you think about the way they connect emotionally, to be able to say, I mean, think of Bernie Sanders. You know, healthcare is a human right. You know, fair housing, good housing is a human right. A high-paying job is a human right. On an emotional level, it sounds good.
That's from the 1937 Marxist handbook. I mean, it's from FDR. We got to go look at it.
And it's from FDR's second Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at it on the surface, well, who doesn't want everyone to have health care? I wish everyone could have health care. I think that would be terrific. But you have to, they don't bring the logic into it. You can't, and by the way, notice that you don't see a lot of left-wing or left-leaning radio shows and podcasts.
Well, they don't make it. Nobody wants to listen to them.
But you know why they don't have them? Because
they have MSNBC and CNN and the major broadcast networks.
And they don't do that well either.
But here's why
with Trump. That was it. Now their audience has fallen way off. I mean, see,
well, the Mueller report coming out the way it did totally destroyed their value proposition.
Absolutely. But here's I'll tell you something about CNN here in just a second. So the reason you don't have a liberal Rush Limbaugh or a liberal Chuck Woolery and a liberal Blunt Force Truth is because when we do topics, we go deep into the topics. You can't go deep into a liberal philosophy.
Yeah, there is no.
Because it falls apart.
Right. It unravels in seconds.
And there is a fundamental notion of underlying economics and basic math. Most of the radical left got really bad grades in math.
I'm not doubting that.
Well, it's funny. And unfortunately, the law schools – unfortunately, have shifted dramatically left as well. And as when I was teaching corporate law, you know, you walk in on the first day of class and say, hey, how many of you went to law school because there's no math on the LSAT? Half the class raises their hand in a corporate law class. And that was a scary moment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. And back to CNN for a second, Chuck. I'll share this with you because, as you know, we do business with CNN.
Right.
CNN's ratings are down so hard right now that, believe it or not, it has made it so the network was completely sold out. Now, you would ask, how could the network be sold out if the ratings are down? because in corporate advertising, when people did their corporate placements last fall for this year, CNN had to guarantee ratings. That's normal. Their ratings are so bad that they're having to give away every TV spot they have as a make good to previous advertisers that didn't get what they paid for.
Well, they were selling eyeball views, and you know, if you have fewer people watching, that's fewer eyeballs.
Right. Now, Mark sells advertising. Mark's in advertising. He does this every day and sells to networks and so on. So let me ask you, Mark, what was the most expensive network you had to sell to, and what was the least expensive that you had to sell to?
You mean as far as where we buy?
These are robocalls coming in on my phone.
Right? I know. You're talking about networks, that national networks that we buy advertising on?
Charge you so much for spot and the ones that were cheaper and the ones that were most expensive.
Okay, so in the world of network news, so in the world of national news,
listen to this, Gavin. This is really interesting.
The best deal in national news is Fox News.
Cheapest.
Yes. Fox News is
least expensive.
A third to a half less than CNN and MSNBC.
Now, isn't that amazing? And yet they're number one. So the number one network is the least expensive of all three.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the states that are the most socialist are where the gas is the most expensive.
Every place liberals are, everything is more expensive, and they blame Republicans for it, which I find infuriating. But I don't know how you fight that.
You know, the thing that we need to figure out, and I don't know how we deal with this, and I'm offer this to both of you.
Well, Arvid DeGavin, he's people, smarter than I am.
When you talk to people.
I'm just a simple country boy with a couple fancy Eastern degrees. Yeah, don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
We all have a log cabin story, Gavin.
Gavin, I have a friend of mine who's got a Harvard degree and an MIT degree. His name's Shiva Iyadora. And he's the guy who invented email. And he's still there at MIT. And Shiva says he went and got a degree from Harvard just so he could tell people how worthless it was.
Well, I feel bad for that kid that got turned down from Harvard, the Parkland survivor. But he's probably going to be better off by not going to Harvard in the
long run. Absolutely, yeah.
Shiva Iyadora actually tells people right now that you will get more value out of taking a trade at a community college than you probably will at a Harvard degree.
Absolutely. Go learn to be a welder. Go learn to be a plumber.
And this is a guy with a Harvard PhD like yourself.
Oh, yeah. No, I can credibly say that more than half of what we teach at the university is totally worthless. Totally worthless.
Shiva, by the way, is running for Senate in Boston, Massachusetts. And his whole position is that Harvard has turned into nothing more than a school of political correctness teaching.
Mm-hmm.
That they're teaching very little actual education, and mostly what they're doing is indoctrinating.
Yes, but my favorite
Franklin School. Did you know that the Franklin School of Germany in the 30s, because the fascists were, you know, cranking down on the communists, and they were communists. You know where they moved out of Germany?
You're probably going to say Harvard.
No, they moved to Columbia University. That's where they are today.
Yes.
The School of Political Correctness is home ground, Columbia University.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned political correctness, and somebody was saying earlier that it had a University of Michigan connection. But my favorite political correctness story is the kid at University of Michigan when they decided that all professors were going to be required to address the students by their preferred pronoun. He went in the system and set his preferred pronoun as Your Majesty.
Yeah, yes.
Right. So yes, it's been my preferred pronoun, and nobody will use it. I'm so so disappointed in my fellow man.
Well, Your Majesty, we're up against the hour.
Gavin, thank you so much. We're going to have all of your information. Well, Mark, you explain it. You're so much
absolutely
better.
Well, if you go to bluntforcetruth.com to the episode with Dr. Gavin Clarkson, you will find links to his website, to his social media. Gavin, I'm assuming you have a Twitter account.
Yeah, it's at Dr. Gavin Clarkson for Twitter. It's Gavin for New Mexico on Facebook. It's gavinclarkson.com on the web. Obviously, we're in deep fundraising mode, so we need as many of your viewers to go to the website and hit the donate button. And you know, and my positions are real straightforward. I'm trying to create jobs. It's economic expansion, empowerment, and enforcement.
So I just found you on Twitter, by the way. I am following you now, and you get a chance to do the same thing, and we'll start retweeting some of your stuff.
You can do that absolutely for me too, since I don't have my Twitter
and
with me.
I'll take care of yours, Chuck, at the moment. You. Folks, you can follow him on Twitter by going to Dr. Gavin Clarkson, or you can go to our show notes. Same with your website. Give us your website again.
It's gavinclarkson.com. That's GAVINCLARKSON.com.
Hopefully terrific. The next time we'll talk to you, it'll be Senator Gavin Clarkson.
Well, hopefully you won't wait that long to have me back on. You know, because
thank you for saying that. I didn't invite you. I just wanted you to invite yourself. So now we'll hold you to that, Gavin.
All right. Sounds good.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much for coming on the show. That's all we have for you today, folks. I hope you enjoyed the episode of Blunt Force Truth, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.